I was out with Tebow and everything was fine, and someone said they would take care of the two drinks I had. As we were leaving, some guy who worked there started yelling at me and then grabbed me. He said, "You need to pay for your drinks." I told him someone else was paying, and Tebow even offered to pay for the drinks to calm him down. And the guy said to me, "No, you're paying for these drinks." And then I walked away and the guy bumped into me. He kept brushing his chest up against me, acting like a tough guy. So I punched him in the ear. I shouldn't have done it. It was stupid. When I left, I hoped that Aaron would straighten up. The week before Florida's 2008 season opener, my mom told me that Aaron had failed a drug test and wouldn't be playing against Hawaii. I thought he was sitting out because of a hamstring injury. So I called Aaron. "Look at the opportunity you have," I said. "What are you doing?" "It's going to be fine," Aaron said. "I'm going to be back next week. Hawaii stinks anyway."
"Aaron, enough is enough," I said. "I love you, but you have got to grow up."
"I know, Dee," Aaron mumbled. "I know." I hung up the phone, wondering one thing. Was Aaron listening to anyone? I thought the suspension would scare Aaron enough so it wouldn't happen again. For several months, Aaron quit smoking marijuana. "But he would wake up in the middle of the night having a nightmare because he thought he smoked," Alyssa said. "He would jump and then wake me up and say, 'Did I smoke? Did I?'" The coaches at Florida started paying more attention to Aaron outside of the facility walls. During his sophomore year, Aaron essentially moved in with his position coach, John Hevesy. Hevesy wanted Aaron to experience the warmth of his loving home. Aaron grew to admire him. Aaron appeared to be on the right path. He had a strong performance in the 2009 national title game against Oklahoma, in which Florida rolled to a 24-14 victory. A few minutes after the final whistle, Aaron ran over to our mother and me to give us a hug. I thought that Aaron's struggles were a thing of the past. For the first time in a long time, the wall he had put up against our mother had been lowered. Aaron's final college game was on January 1st, 2010, at the Allstate Sugar Bowl in New Orleans, where Florida defeated Cincinnati 51-24. I met with Coach Meyer and another assistant before the game at the team hotel near the Superdome. "Aaron needs to go to the NFL, a Gator assistant told me, "because he may never make it out of Florida if he doesn't leave now." The coaches were worried that Aaron would miss his entire senior season because of his excessive marijuana use and the likelihood of more failed drug tests. All I knew was one thing. If Aaron wanted to smoke, he was going to smoke. Period. End of story. Following the bowl game, Aaron and I flew out to California, where he began training for the NFL Combine, where NFL teams evaluate draft-eligible players. But then he hurt his back during workouts. Aaron had experienced recurring back problems at Florida. He had received 7 epidurals, and there were times he could barely walk. Other times, his back hurt so badly he had difficulty breathing. Aaron never wanted to show that he was in pain, a lesson from our father. The back injury he suffered in California meant he couldn't participate in any of the physical tests held at the NFL Combine in Indianapolis, where NFL prospects showcase their physical ability every February. Prior to the start of the Combine, Aaron received another epidural so he could walk normally and meet with teams. A few weeks later, with his back pain relieved, Aaron took part in Florida's Pro Day, an event where NFL coaches and scouts came to campus to evaluate the Gators' top prospects. Afterward, he called me. "How did you do?" I asked. "Good," he said. "But I didn't run the greatest." "Mom told me you did great on the bench press, though," I said. "Why do you think I did 30 reps of 225 pounds? Aaron asked. "What do you mean?" "Because I was high," he said. "Don't tell me I can't perform when I'm smoking."
Chapter 14. April 2010. 3 days before the NFL draft, the arrangements had been made.
Our entire family was going to watch the draft at our mother's house in Connecticut.
I was in the car with Aaron on our way to meet them when our mom called me and said, "I'm done. I'm not doing it."
"What's going on?" Aaron had told her that he wouldn't attend if Jeff was present. I turned to Aaron and said, "Mom canceled. She doesn't want anyone to come over." Aaron didn't say much. I told him that we could watch the draft at my apartment with his agent, my fiancé, and one of his high school friends.
"Okay, that's fine," he said.
At my apartment, I could tell Aaron was nervous. He was biting the fingernail on his right index finger nonstop. His agent pulled me aside to tell me that this could be a long few days. "There are teams that love Aaron, but there are teams that won't touch him because of their concerns about his character," he said. "There's a chance he could drop pretty far." The first round passed, and Aaron wasn't picked.
"I didn't think my name would get called today," Aaron said. "We all believed Aaron would be selected in the second or third round on the second day of the draft."
The next evening, the five of us were back on my living room sectional, our eyes glued to the television. More names were called from the podium in New York City. I started pacing the hardwood floor behind the couch, concerned that Aaron might not be picked at all. During commercial breaks, I'd go outside with Aaron's agent and we'd skip rocks on the gravel driveway as we discussed Aaron's draft status. I questioned everything. Did Aaron make the right decision leaving school early? Did his past mistakes cost him a shot at being drafted? Is he even going to get drafted? What will he do if football doesn't work out for him? The second round ended. Then the third round ended. I told Aaron, "I hope you realize how much your decisions at Florida hurt you. You are a first-round talent."
"It's going to be okay, D," he said. "There's nothing I can do now. I just want to get drafted and prove to them what kind of player I am, and prove to them that I'm going to be the best tight end ever."
"Aaron, your ability was never questioned," I said. "It was your decision-making." On the third and final day of the draft, we reconvened. I was a nervous wreck. Midway through the fourth round, Aaron's cell phone rang. We all rose to our feet. Aaron answered and began walking around the room with the phone held to his ear. I followed closely behind.
"Thank you for the opportunity," Aaron said into the phone. "Thank you so much."
Aaron hung up.
"I'm going to be playing for New England," he said.
With the 15th pick in the fourth round and the 113th pick overall, the Patriots selected my brother. New England was his favorite team as a child. He had a Drew Bledsoe jersey he often wore at recess. He was now living his childhood dream. I was crying, and he was smiling like a kid who had just opened a Christmas gift he'd been asking for his entire life. We wrapped our arms around each other. "Don't ever do this to me again," I said. "Be smart. Be smart." We went to a sports bar a mile from my apartment to celebrate with our family, minus our mother, who was still upset with Aaron. We played pool and everyone danced. As the night was coming to an end, I noticed Aaron walking outside. I asked him where he was going.
"I'm going to the casino," he said.
Aaron planned to go to Mohegan Sun, 30 minutes away, with a friend who had been drinking. "Why are you going to get in the car with someone who has been drinking? You just dropped to the fourth round because of the stupid decisions you made at Florida. Come on!" I was angry, shouting at Aaron, telling him not to go. Jerry, one of our older cousins, came outside and tried talking some sense into Aaron, but he wouldn't listen to him either. Then a few of Aaron's friends approached me and said I was overreacting. I became emotional as Aaron walked toward the car. Jerry placed his left arm around me and said, "All you can do is try. If he refuses to listen to you, there is nothing you can do." 5 days after the draft, I flew back to Europe, where I was completing my second season as a player coach for an American football team in Klagenfurt, Austria. Aaron and I talked face-to-face on Skype, and he often repeated, "I can't believe I'm a New England Patriot," with the enthusiasm of a little kid. But Aaron was still a kid. At age 20, he was the youngest player in the NFL. I also emailed Aaron articles that mentioned his past mistakes, because I wanted him to remain humble and know that he still had a lot of room for improvement. When I returned to Connecticut after 6 weeks in Austria, I accepted a job as the head football coach at Southington High School in Connecticut. When Aaron had time off from training with the Patriots, he would drive 2 hours to train with our team. He worked with all the skilled players on their quickness and route running techniques. Aaron's face shined when he helped a kid complete a drill that he had been struggling with.
Chapter 15. Fall, 2010. On September 12th, the sky was blue. The leaves were starting to turn orange and yellow, and the air was warm as I walked with my mother toward Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, where the Patriots were hosting the Cincinnati Bengals, Aaron's first NFL regular season game. Kickoff was at 1 p.m. We moved through the turnstile and started looking for our seats. But before we reached them, I grabbed my mother by the arm. "I'm going back down to get closer to the field," I said. "I've got to see Aaron warm up." I descended the stadium steps, marveling at all the fans in their Patriot jerseys as the pregame music blared. I imagined one day seeing hordes of fans adorned in Aaron's number, with his last name on the back, cheering him on. I neared the bottom row of the stands, directly behind one of the goalposts. At the top of my lungs, I yelled, "Aaron!" He didn't hear me. I tried again and started waving my hands over my head. He finally turned. He raised his right hand to his face mask and then extended it at me like he was blowing me a kiss. I thought about how emotional our dad would be if he were here. I went back up to join my mother at our seats to watch the game, our eyes glued to Aaron whenever he was on the field. Then it happened. With 11 minutes 27 seconds remaining in the first quarter and the Patriots facing a first and 10 on their own 41-yard line, Tom Brady took the snap. He dropped back before firing a short pass to the left side of the field. Aaron caught the ball in stride and turned on the speed. On his first NFL reception, Aaron gained 45 yards to the Bengals' 14-yard line. I was screaming as loud as I could. The Patriots won the game, 38-24. The next week against the Jets, Aaron caught 6 passes for 101 yards, becoming the youngest player since 1960 to top 100 receiving yards in a single game. 7 days later, against the Bills, he led the Patriots in receiving with 6 catches for 65 yards. He also had 1 rush for 13 yards. Aaron finished the season with 45 catches for 563 yards and 6 touchdowns. In the offseason, Aaron had to have hip surgery to repair a slight muscle tear. In February, shortly after his procedure, I invited Aaron and 5 of my friends, including our high school football coach, to my bachelor party. Aaron rented a party bus for the group to ride to Atlantic City, New Jersey, but at the last moment, Aaron told me he wouldn't go unless he brought 2 of his high school friends. "Aaron, come on. You're my best man," I said. "It's for 2 days. You can leave your friends for 2 days." He said okay and that he understood, but when the party bus arrived at my apartment, his 2 friends were sitting in the back. I let it go. Still recovering from his surgery, Aaron was in a wheelchair. He paid the party bus driver to be his official wheelchair pusher for the night. We ate dinner at a Brazilian steakhouse. Aaron ordered chicken fingers off the kids' menu, cracking up everyone at the table. Aaron's friends laughed along, but they stayed to themselves the entire night. After dinner, we went to a club. Aaron sat off to the side with our coach the entire time, and they shared stories about his playing days in Bristol. This was when Aaron was always his happiest, talking about the times when he was surrounded by friends and family, by love. Our waitress had a Florida Gators logo on her cell phone screensaver. "You're a Gators fan?"
our coach asked.
Oh my gosh, I love the Gators, she said.
What do you think of that Hernandez guy? He asked, with Aaron sitting next to him in his wheelchair.
He's such a great player, she said.
I think he sucks, our coach said. Did you see him throw the ball into the stands against Florida State? Who does he think he is?
I was there. It was crazy. It was the best play of the game.
Then Aaron spoke up.
He's a bum, Aaron said.
I'm a Florida State fan.
Aaron started doing the Seminole tomahawk chop with his right hand.
You guys don't know what you're talking about, she said as she turned and left.
We doubled over in laughter. We called it a night and headed to our hotel. Aaron was rolled to his room. The next morning, as we gathered in the lobby to leave, Aaron and his two friends were nowhere to be found. I went back to his hotel room door and knocked. No answer. I walked the casino floor. An hour after we were scheduled to leave, I finally got a key to his room from the front desk and opened the door. Aaron was tucked under the covers of the king-size bed with his two friends, their shirts off, even though it was a luxury suite with multiple beds.
Hey, what the hell are you doing? I asked. We're all waiting for you so we can leave.
Aaron popped up.
We'll be right down, he said, as the other two began to stir.
Once we got home, I shut my bedroom door in my apartment so Aaron and I could have privacy, away from the other guys in my living room. I asked Aaron if he was gay.
If you are, I don't care, I said. I love you. You're my brother.
Don't you ever ask me that again, Aaron said. If you say that again, I'll fucking kill you.
Chapter 16 Fall, 2011. On March 4th, at St. Matthew's Church in Bristol, Aaron stood next to me at the altar. The doors opened, and my bride appeared. As she neared me, I felt a squeeze on my right shoulder. I looked at Aaron, and he was crying, one of the few times I'd seen him shed a tear since we lost our father. At the reception, Aaron gave the best man speech at the Aqua Turf Club in Southington. He was full of jokes.
"Hey, listen, if there are any cans in here, make sure you give them to my brother," he said. "Because if we were at a party, DJ would be the one who would ask, 'Hey, are you done with that can?' My brother would collect the cans so the next day he could take them to the grocery store to collect a nickel."
Everyone laughed.
"And make sure when it's time to eat, we eat," he said. "And when it's time to dance, we dance. Because, you know, my brother and his damn itineraries, he's so damn particular."
More laughter ensued. 8 months later, on November 6th, 2011, the Patriots hosted the New York Giants at Gillette Stadium. Aaron caught four passes for 35 yards and a touchdown, but New England lost, 24-20. I watched the game from my office in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was working as the quarterback's coach at Brown University. On Sundays, the staff began formulating our game plan for the upcoming opponent, and we usually didn't leave until after midnight, which meant I would miss Aaron's 22nd birthday party that night. My mom drove from Bristol to Aaron's condo, which was only a few miles from Gillette Stadium. She was hoping that this would be a night to celebrate Aaron and all that he had accomplished. All she wanted was an enjoyable, fight-free evening with her son. She walked in and saw a buffet of food spread out on the kitchen table. Aaron's girlfriend, Cheyenne, whom he had reconnected with since returning from Florida, had put together a tower of cupcakes. Some of his friends made my mom nervous. One friend, who went by the name Sherrod, a.k.a. Alexander Bradley, was a convicted drug dealer from East Hartford, Connecticut. He was one of many bad influences now hovering in Aaron's inner circle. My mother went downstairs to have a cigarette. She opened the door to the garage, and there was Aaron, alone in the dark, sitting on the hood of his black Range Rover, cleaning a handgun.
"Aaron, what are you doing?"
our mom asked, concerned.
"Why do you have a gun? Are you stupid?" Aaron lifted his eyes and flashed a disgusted look. He remained silent and kept cleaning his gun. My mom went back inside. A few minutes later, Aaron was called upstairs for the celebration. As soon as he appeared in front of his cake, his smile was back. The fun-loving, approachable Aaron had returned. My mother was stunned at his transformation. Moments earlier, he seemed withdrawn and depressed, and in a bad mental place. Now he was a picture of happiness. Everyone sang happy birthday before Aaron blew out his candles. He asked one of his friends to arrange for a party bus to come to his place. The destination? A Boston nightclub. Our mom would not be joining them. "Aaron wasn't the kid I remembered," our mom told me later. "It was like he wasn't my kid anymore. His attitude was getting worse and worse. I had no clue what was going on with him and couldn't understand his selection of friends. I knew he was going the wrong way, and I told him this, but he was drifting further and further away. He would call me and say, 'I hate you because you don't even know me.' That really hurt." The party bus arrived. One of our cousins and her boyfriend hadn't planned on going out, and they weren't dressed appropriately for a night on the town, so they told Aaron they couldn't go. "You're about the same size as Cheyenne, so you could wear some of her clothes," Aaron said. "And your boyfriend can wear something of mine." Once everyone was dressed, they filed onto the party bus. On board, my cousin offered to chip in for the expenses. Then Sherrod stood up and said, "Nah, I got it. Right, Aaron? You don't ever have to touch your pockets when you with me, Aaron, right? Tell him." Sherrod made my cousin feel uncomfortable. "Sherrod kept talking about how much everything cost," she told me. "He would be like, 'Do you see these bracelets right here? This is worth $10,000. He went on and on, saying, "This diamond is worth this, and this is worth that." I remember sitting there with everyone and thinking, "Who is this clown, and why is he here?" That was a question all of us asked when we met Sherrod. The first time I was introduced to him, I had arrived at Aaron's condo after watching him play at Gillette Stadium. I walked inside and sat in the living room with a few family members. We were talking when I spotted a man I didn't recognize walking up the stairs from the ground floor entrance. I was looking in his direction because I thought it was Aaron coming back from his game, but it was Sherrod. He was about 6 feet tall, light-skinned, wearing glasses, and had short hair in waves. Without saying a word or making any eye contact, he walked through our conversation and continued on past the kitchen, down the hall, and up the stairs, where no one was at the time. As he strutted past us, my aunt saw the look on my face, a look that said, "Who the hell is this?" My aunt caught my attention and mouthed the word "trouble" while shaking her head very slowly. A few minutes later, I heard the door shut downstairs, and then footsteps. It was Aaron. He came up behind me, gave me a hug, and smiled at everyone in the room. We started talking about the game until Sherrod came back down the stairs. It was like a balloon popped, the way Aaron's demeanor changed. He became visibly uneasy. The party bus pulled up to the Cure Lounge. Several of Aaron's Patriot teammates were inside. Aaron and his guests sat at tables near them. At one point, Aaron stepped out of the club into a private area to smoke a joint. Our cousin asked him, "Are you sure that's okay? You're not going to smell? Aren't people watching you, Aaron?" Aaron smiled back at her. "It's all good," he said. "They let me do it here all the time." Chapter 17. January 14th, 2012. The evening began with so much promise, so much joy at Gillette Stadium. The temperature had dipped into the teens. My breath shot out in white puffs, but man, I was so proud. as I watched my younger brother during pregame warm-ups for the divisional playoff game against the Denver Broncos. On this winter evening in New England, Aaron was as dominating as ever, as versatile as ever. He lined up all over the field, tight end, wide receiver, and running back. Aaron caught 4 passes for 55 yards and 1 touchdown while rushing for 61 yards. It was hard to fathom that a player with that much talent was related to me. New England won the game, 45-10. After the game, Aaron was asked in the locker room by reporters if he would be ready for the AFC Championship game the following Sunday. "I feel great," Aaron said. "I love running back. I hope Coach Bill Belichick keeps letting me do it. It doesn't matter, whatever I can do to help this team to get to the next game." Once Aaron was finished with his team responsibilities, I met him outside the locker room, unaware that the medical staff had examined him for a head injury in the 4th quarter. A Patriots employee then guided Aaron, my wife, 2 of his friends, and myself onto a golf cart and drove us to Aaron's SUV, parked in a private lot for the players. Aaron was quiet, but seemed content, satisfied, ready to head home and enjoy a relaxing evening at his condominium. Aaron got in the driver's side. Aaron usually let others do the driving, but tonight he felt like being in control of the vehicle. I took a seat in back. Aaron flipped on the ignition and pulled out of the lot at a slow roll. We approached a police officer directing traffic. Aaron inched closer until the officer extended his hand, signaling for us to stop. The wheels at rest, the engine idling, I noticed Aaron's eyes moving back and forth from the officer to somewhere to his right. He looked like he was panicking. Then, without saying anything, Aaron slammed down on the gas pedal, nearly striking the cop in front of us and the oncoming traffic. I turned my head back at the officer Aaron had almost hit. "What the fuck are you doing?" I yelled to Aaron from the back seat as I watched the officer rush to his cruiser. "Pull over. He's coming. His lights are on." The officer was 25 yards behind us. Aaron hit the accelerator harder, causing my head to snap back, the engine now in full thunder. Suddenly, we were speeding down a dark and narrow back road with a police cruiser chasing us. Aaron jumped from lane to race around the cars in front of us, while also dodging oncoming headlights. "Stop the car, Aaron! Please stop the car!" Aaron ignored my words. It was as if he were alone in the vehicle. I again looked back at the oncoming officer, who was now only a few cars behind us, the red and blue lights flashing in the dark night. One of Aaron's friends thought it was funny, and was laughing. "What the fuck are you doing? Pull over," I pleaded. "Why are you running from the cops? Aaron, you're going to kill us." I jabbed Aaron on his right shoulder. He didn't say one word. After a few minutes, Aaron took a hard right. My body was thrown to the left as Aaron snapped the wheel down. I squeezed the front passenger's headrest with my hands, bracing myself, fearful that the SUV would tip and roll. He slammed on the brakes. I could feel the SUV slide until it came to a standstill, just to the left of a dark storage unit. Aaron turned off his car and stared in the rearview mirror. "What are you thinking, Aaron?" I yelled. "Calm down," he said, as the cop zipped by and disappeared into the distance. He turned the SUV's low beams back on, grabbed the steering wheel, backed up over the gravel, and then drove off. He never said another word about it. From the back seat, I was consumed with one question. What is going on with my brother? Chapter 18. February 5th, 2012. Arriving at our seats, I couldn't sit down. I had butterflies in my stomach. My brother was playing in the Super Bowl. Kelly Clarkson was introduced to sing the national anthem. The drums rattled and the crowd quieted. Her powerful voice echoed. Aaron and I had watched her compete on season one of American Idol. Now, my brother stood 50 feet from her. Looking up at the Jumbotron, I saw Tom Brady, his eye black neatly swiped, mouthing the words of the anthem. I scanned the crowd, looking at all the cameras flashing. Then I lifted my gaze back up at the Jumbotron. There was my brother on the big screen, slowly swaying back and forth, like he had before his 1,000th-point game in high school. I thought about all the times Aaron and I watched the Super Bowl in our living room, on our version of a big screen. Before the game, we would watch our dad prepare his own special recipe of chicken wings, Frank's hot sauce, a stick of butter, and several shakes of garlic salt. Then we would unfold our 4 wooden trays in front of our spots on the sofa. Nibbling on the wings, as a family, we would embrace the Super Bowl action together. The Patriots led 10-9 at halftime. Early in the third quarter, facing a 2nd-and-2 at the Giants' 12-yard line, New England lined up with no running backs in the backfield, an empty formation. From my seat, I could see that Aaron would be isolated against a linebacker in the middle of the field. Aaron loved one-on-one matchups because it gave him the ability to use his quickness and athleticism in the open field. My eyes were glued to him as the ball was snapped. Aaron fired out of his stance to press the defender back on his heels. Aaron stopped on a dime, then gave the linebacker a hard juke and head fake to the outside, before cutting underneath him to the inside. Brady delivered a quick strike to Aaron, who turned up the field and crossed the goal line for a touchdown. The Patriots led 17-9. But New England couldn't put the Giants away. With less than a minute remaining in the game, New England trailed 21-17 and had the ball in its 20-yard line. On 1st-and-10, Brady and Deion Branch couldn't connect over the middle. On 2nd-and-10, Aaron dropped a pass across the middle from Brady. Then, Brady was sacked, forcing New England to take their final timeout with 36 seconds left. On 4th-and-16, Brady eluded the rush, flipped his hips, and fired a pass down the left sideline to Branch for a 19-yard gain before stepping out of bounds, stopping the clock with 32 seconds. The next play, Aaron caught another ball from Brady, this one an 11-yard gain to the Patriots' 44-yard line. 19 seconds remained. Two plays later, with 5 seconds left, New England had the ball on its own 49-yard line. There was time for one last play. "Please, Father, help us," I prayed. The ball was snapped. Brady shuffled around in the pocket, avoiding the 3-man rush, and then heaved it as high and as far as he could. I looked to the end zone. Aaron was preparing to catch the Hail Mary. Aaron set his feet to jump in the middle of the end zone as 5 defenders collapsed around him. Aaron leaped and extended his arms, but one of the New York defensive backs hit the ball just before it touched Aaron's fingertips. End over end, the ball fell to the turf. The game was over. New York won 21-17. Aaron, who had caught a team-high 8 passes for 67 yards and 1 touchdown, dropped to the ground. I watched him closely. It was as if the loss had caused his body to fall limp. He sat in the end zone in shock. His teammate, Rob Gronkowski, helped him to his feet. It was more than a game. Later that night, I stood in a long line outside an Indianapolis hotel with other team family members, waiting to attend a post-game celebration. I was with my wife and mother. "Hey, where did you sit?" I asked my mom. I had tried to find her in the stands before the game started, but I couldn't see her. "I was so embarrassed," my mother said. "I sat down, and here comes Aaron's friend Beau with a prostitute, and they sat right next to us. It was ridiculous. Why would Aaron invite them, and why would he sit them right next to me?" I was taken aback by this news. Minutes later, I spotted Aaron exiting a vehicle with Tanya and his friend Sherrod. Aaron and Sherrod wore matching outfits, blue Gucci shirts with little G's scattered in a pattern, the same pants and similar shoes. I caught up to Aaron and told him that we had a spot saved in line. He said to follow him. I ran back and told my wife and mother that Aaron said to come with him.
A few hours later, I saw Barry Sanders,
the former Detroit Lions running back who had been my favorite player growing up. Starstruck, I put my Bud Light bottle down at the nearest table and asked him for a picture. "Please, Barry, you're my favorite player, and you're one of my brothers as well," I said.
"Who's your brother?" he asked.
I told him.
"He's a good player," Barry said.
"Go get him, and we'll get a picture of the three of us." I ran to grab Aaron. I told him that we could take a picture with Barry Sanders. We bolted to his side. We thanked Barry at least 5 times. Walking away, we stared in wonderment at the picture on my phone like the adoring kids we still were inside. Aaron never acknowledged our mother or spoke to her that night, so she left early. "I had to leave," she said. "I was so upset and angry. I was burning up inside over how he treated me."
Chapter 19. Spring, 2012. After the Super Bowl, I resumed my life in Providence as the quarterback's coach at Brown University. My entire identity was wrapped around football. The game kidnapped my mind and my heart. Everything else was secondary. My wife would talk to me, and it was as if she were conversing with a wall. "Are you still thinking about football?" she'd ask. I would hang my head and say, "Yes." At the time, I didn't realize how mixed up my priorities were. My wife and I had been together for 7 years and married for 1. She had been with me as I weathered the storm of my father's death and helped me overcome my mother's betrayal with Jeff. She was the family I needed when my own family was falling apart. On the weekend of our 1-year anniversary, my wife and I decided to celebrate in New York City together. I had to work on Friday night, and that evening she told me she planned to stay at a friend's house. The next morning, we drove 2 hours to Manhattan, to a hotel in the theater district. I asked about her evening, but she didn't share many details, other than to say it had been a low-key night. Then, 20 minutes into our drive, she was out cold, in a deep sleep, her head resting against the passenger's window. As I continued to drive, I sensed something was wrong. I didn't understand why she was so tired. When we reached our hotel, I pretended that everything was fine. That night, we went to the musical Wicked at the Gershwin Theater, my first Broadway show. We had a great time, but I couldn't shake this lingering feeling that something wasn't right. I remember thinking, "It's probably just me, and I'm overthinking the situation." On Sunday night, we returned to our apartment in Providence. On Monday morning, I gave her a kiss before heading to work. When I reached the office, I couldn't concentrate. I started to think, is she seeing someone else? I needed to figure this out. I logged on to our shared AT&T account and scanned our call history. One number stood out because it had been dialed more often than others, and at odd hours. I pulled out a piece of paper and wrote the number down. At first, I pushed in a few digits, but then talked myself out of calling, even getting mad at myself for not trusting my wife. But then I did it. I entered the numbers into my cell phone. The knot in my stomach turned tighter as the phone rang. I prayed that a woman would answer.
"Hello?"
a male voice said. I hung up and immediately found myself struggling to breathe. Despite the evidence, I didn't want to accuse her of anything without gathering more information. Every night I would go home and try to build up the courage to ask her about the number, but I couldn't because I feared the truth. For a few weeks, I tracked her calls. Then, one evening, while she was in the bathroom preparing for another evening out, her cell phone vibrated on her nightstand. The message, from an unidentified number, the same one I had noted in our call history, read, "Am I going to see you tonight?" With her iPhone in my hand, I paced around our bedroom. I started taking deep breaths, so deep that I grew lightheaded and had to sit on the edge of our bed. I couldn't hold it in any longer. I finally went into the bathroom to confront her. She was in the shower. I slid the curtain open and held up the text message she had received. After wiping the water from her face, she looked at the phone. Her chin dropped and her eyes turned toward mine. I was shaking as I asked, "Who is this?"
"I don't know," she said.
I asked again. She then claimed it was a friend.
"Why don't you have this friend's number saved in your contacts, like the rest of your friends?"
She looked at me for several seconds and said nothing. At that moment, I knew my marriage was in trouble. Several days later, I called my brother. "I think my wife is seeing someone else," I said. There was a long, silent pause on the phone. Then,
"Damn. Are you okay, Dee? Where are you?"
"I am driving back to my house right now," I said. "I don't know what to do or where to go."
"Come over to my place," he said.
I packed a few belongings and drove to Aaron's, 30 minutes away. Aaron greeted me at the front door. He was alone that night. We walked inside and he showed me to the second floor bedroom. I hung up my clothes and then went to his family room, where Aaron was watching television. Aaron kept telling me, "Dee, you're young. You will get through this." But I couldn't stop thinking about the lack of love and attention I gave her. I couldn't stop beating myself up for choosing football over my wife. I walked down the stairs and into the kitchen to boil a pot of water for macaroni and cheese. Aaron went to his bedroom. Once my food was ready, I went to see what he was doing. Entering the room, I saw the bottom drawer of his dresser open and stuffed with bags of marijuana. I grew nervous. He started introducing the bags by name, as if they were people with personalities. I couldn't believe it. After shutting the dresser drawers, Aaron peeked out his blinds and looked at the surrounding windows of other condos. I thought he was about to get busted for having so much weed. "If I ever get caught around this shit, I'll be done," I said. "I'll be fired from Brown, and there's no way in hell I'll be able to get another job." From the other side of the room, I spotted a big kitchen knife in the top drawer of his nightstand. It was to the left of his bed, close to the window he was looking out of. "Aaron, why the hell is that big knife in your nightstand?" I asked.
"I sleep with it because people are after me," he said. "I've got it for protection."
"Who is after you, Aaron?" I asked.
"Everyone," he said. "The FBI, everyone."
"What did you do?" I asked.
"Nothing," he said. "Nothing at all."
I was very confused by his paranoia. He genuinely believed someone was out to get him, and he couldn't communicate why. At one point, he went back to the window and said,
"They're probably watching us right now."
I assumed he was acting this way because of the marijuana. We walked back outside. I had to get a few more belongings out of my car, and he had to throw his trash in the dumpster. We continued to talk, but in the middle of our conversation, he shifted his eyes to the left to look at the neighbor's windows he had been staring at before from his bedroom. But he wouldn't lift his head up to look. He only moved his eyes. He whispered,
"They are watching us and listening to us right now."
Aaron's actions were starting to make me paranoid, enough that I told him I was going to head back home.
"Dee, don't worry," he said in his normal voice. "Everything's fine."
I looked at him closely. I couldn't figure him out. I decided to stay. I walked back up the stairs and went to bed. After work the next day, I drove to Aaron's, packed my car, and I told him I was going to sleep at home. He asked me to stay with him another night, but I said I couldn't.
"Is this because of last night?" he asked.
"Yes," I said.
"Everything is fine," he replied, and started laughing at me.
He didn't realize how scattered his thoughts were as he worried about the people who were after him. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what to do, but I knew I had to leave. I returned home and went directly into the spare bedroom.
Chapter 20. Spring, 2012. A few weeks later, as my wife and I were going through divorce proceedings, I was walking across Brown's campus when my cell phone started to vibrate in my pocket. It was one of my former UConn teammates, who was now a graduate assistant at the University of Miami. "The Miami coaches would like to meet with you," he told me. "There's an opening as an offensive graduate assistant on the staff. Would you be interested in flying down here for an interview?"
"Yes," I replied.
After hanging up the phone, I immediately went into the office of my head coach to make him aware of the job opportunity at Miami. Then I phoned Aaron, asking for his advice about interviewing with the Hurricanes.
"Follow your heart, D," he said. "Plus, Miami is beautiful. You have to go look at it. Miami is big time."
Next, I called Coach Edsel at UConn. He thought I should stay at Brown. "There are too many guys jumping around from job to job," he said. "If you do a good job at Brown, everything will work out." I phoned other coaches for their advice and got even more conflicting opinions. I dialed Aaron again. "Some coaches are telling me to leave Brown if I'm offered the position, and some are telling me to stay," I said. "I don't know what to do."
"D," he said, laughing, "this is exactly how I felt when I was in high school trying to decide between UConn and Florida. I had so many people telling me to stay at UConn and so many others saying it would be best for my career to go to Florida. It's crazy how things work out. But if you accept the job, I have a place you can stay in. It's right on the beach and it's a penthouse. You could stay there for a few months until you find a place of your own." I decided to interview for the position, and I was offered the job. I went back to my head coach's office, my wedding ring no longer on my finger, and told him I was heading to Miami. He was concerned that I was running away from my failed marriage. Days later, as I packed my belongings into the back of a U-Haul for the 28-hour drive south, Aaron stopped by my apartment.
"You're going to coach at the U! At the U!" he said. "You are going to do it, D. You're going to be a big-time coach one day."
I arrived at my brother's off-season rental in Hallandale, Florida. Easing into the parking lot in my Jetta, I spotted BMWs, Bentleys, Range Rovers, and Rolls-Royces. Then I looked up. The building stretched so high that it seemed like it was puncturing the clouds. There were 51 floors in the oceanfront property, and Aaron's place was on the 48th. As I walked into the lobby, I must have looked like a wide-eyed tourist, the way I gazed in wonder at everything. I rode the elevator to the 48th floor, opened the door to the suite, and was overwhelmed. The furniture looked like it was too expensive to even touch. Floor-to-ceiling glass windows wrapped around the entire suite. A balcony opened up to a breathtaking view of Fort Lauderdale. The back end of the suite offered a stunning view of the Atlantic Ocean. I called Aaron, who was still in New England, preparing for training camp, which was 2 months away. "This is the most amazing place I have ever seen," I said. He was happy that I liked it, but had a few requests. I could only sleep in the spare bedroom, I wasn't allowed to drive his Range Rover, and I had to be careful about who I let inside the place. I told him I understood. All of that sounded reasonable. Aaron and Shai, who was pregnant, showed up at the high-rise a few weeks later. The three of us spent time together talking, telling stories, and laughing.
I could tell Aaron was in love.
Sitting on the couch, he would gaze adoringly at her and rub and kiss her growing belly. After a few days, they returned to New England. About a week later, I was getting ready to go out with a few other Miami coaches when I heard the front door open. I peeked my head around the corner. It was Sherrod. He was carrying a black duffel bag over his right shoulder. He was alone.
"What's up, Dee?"
he said, as he walked past the bathroom door and into the living room. I heard a noise that sounded like something had fallen onto the ground. I left the bathroom to see what was going on. The black duffel bag was on the kitchen floor, empty. On a glass table was a 2-foot mountain of cash, all in stacks of $100 bills. Then I saw a gun on the table,
the first gun I'd ever seen outside the movies. It was silver and black, and it looked very small. My heart started racing. I tried to play it cool because I didn't want to look weak, but inside, I was terrified, and thinking, what the fuck, what the fuck, what the fuck? Sherrod went out onto the balcony. The doors were left open, and the big white drapes were blowing inside the suite. He was pacing back and forth. I grabbed my wallet and headed toward the front door, but then the front door opened again. It was Aaron.
"Where are you going?" Aaron asked. "You look fly."
"I'm going to meet up with some of the other coaches," I said. "I wish I knew you were coming. Why didn't you even call to let me know?" Then I nodded my head in the direction of where the gun and the money were.
"What the hell is that?"
"Don't worry about it, Dee," he said. He bent down and flipped my pants up, cuffing them.
"Now you look fresh," he said.
Sherrod walked back inside from the balcony and said, "Dee, come over here." He handed me $300 bills.
"Have fun tonight," he said.
After dinner and drinks with my fellow coaches, I returned to Aaron's apartment. All the lights were on. Aaron was alone on the sofa. The gun and the cash were no longer on the table. I sat next to him. He was holding a white iPad and staring at the screen. I inched closer to him. He was viewing Patriots practice film. I rose to go to bed. Aaron said,
"Dee, I'm going to be the best tight end to ever play the game."
7 hours later, I opened my bedroom door and Aaron was on the couch and still watching film.
"Did you sleep?" I asked.
"No. I told you, I'm going to be the best tight end to ever play this game." The next day, Aaron left to return to Massachusetts. The start of training camp was approaching. Chapter 21. June 2012. A few weeks later, in June 2012, the coaching staff at Miami had a summer break, so I went home to Bristol and stayed at a friend's house for 2 weeks. Jeff was living at my mother's, and I didn't want to be there. One night, Aaron called me and asked me if I could pick him up at Logan International Airport in Boston. I told him I had plans with our cousin Jay. Aaron said to bring him along. Aaron also asked me to swing by his condo to grab some clothes for him on the way to the airport. He said he had rented hotel rooms in Boston and we could go out together after we picked him up. Once Aaron got into the car, the three of us went to the hotel. Aaron took his time getting ready. He didn't like to go out until it was late, around 11:30 p.m. There was an unexpected knock on the hotel room door. Sherrod walked in.
Jay, who brought his hair clippers, was giving Aaron a haircut.
"Why do you hang out with Sherrod?" Jay asked, as he was cutting Aaron's hair. "That dude isn't your real friend. He doesn't care about you."
Sherrod overheard Jay and started arguing with him.
"I don't ask him for money," Sherrod said. "I don't need his money."
"What the hell does money have to do with anything?" Jay asked. I was sitting on a chair in the corner of the red-carpeted room, drinking a Bacardi Razz and Sprite in one of the glass cups the hotel provided. All I wanted was for everyone to hurry up so we could leave. As soon as our cousin finished trimming Aaron's hair, I said, "We didn't drive all the way up to Boston to hang out with a bunch of dudes in a hotel room all night. We're going to head out now, so just text me when you and Sherrod are ready." Later that night, we met Aaron and Sherrod at a bar near the hotel. I spotted a few basketball players I went to college with. We chatted for a few minutes about football and their playing careers in Europe. Then I went back to the bar where Aaron and Sherrod were standing. Aaron looked like he was in a state of panic.
"You trust too many people. You shouldn't be talking to those guys," he said.
As he spoke, he kept looking back at them, like he thought one of my friends was planning to hit him over the head with a bottle or something. "Aaron, I know these guys from college," I said. "We're friends." For several minutes, Aaron didn't take his eyes off them. He was being paranoid, and I didn't understand why. The next morning, Jay and I went to say goodbye to my brother. When we opened his hotel room door, we started laughing. Aaron was lying face down under the covers, with his arms and legs sprawled out and falling off both sides of the bed. I started poking him. He didn't budge. I tried rolling him over, but he was too heavy. For a second, we thought something was wrong. I ran to the bathroom, filled up a little trash can with water, and splashed it on the back of Aaron's head. He quickly popped up.
"What the hell is going on?" he groggily said. "I'm trying to sleep."
"We got nervous because you weren't moving," Jay said.
"All I need is a blunt and I'll be all right," Aaron said.
Chapter 22. Fall 2012. On Friday, August 31st, I was back in Massachusetts for Miami's season opener against Boston College. On the eve of the game, I met one of my former teammates at a pub. Drinking a few beers and eating chicken wings, we reminisced about our playing days at UConn and overseas. During our conversation, my iPhone chimed. The message from Aaron read, "We made it, D. We made it." I stepped outside and called Aaron.
"We are set for life, D," he said.
"I just signed a new contract worth $40 million and a $12.5 million signing bonus." I almost lost my breath. I couldn't believe it. Aaron had just received the largest signing bonus ever given to an NFL tight end. The $40 million total was the second largest extension ever for a tight end, behind his teammate Rob Gronkowski. If Aaron handled his money wisely, he would be financially stable for the rest of his life.
"The first thing I'm going to do is donate $50,000 to the Kraft family," he said.
Robert Kraft, the Patriots' owner, had taken a chance on Aaron in the draft 2 years earlier. His wife Myra had passed away from cancer a year earlier, and Aaron wanted to give to their foundation.
"This is just the beginning for you," I told him. "Remember that the NFL is a business, and they gave you this contract for a reason. You have to keep producing."
After hanging up, I rejoined my college teammate.
"Is everything okay?" he asked.
"My brother just signed a contract extension with the Patriots," I said.
Then, my phone still in my hand, it chimed again.
I was amazed. Aaron had sent me an image of the $2 million deposit he had just made into his bank account. I carefully counted all the zeros, and then shared the photo with my friend. Everything in my brother's career seemed to be falling into place. He was about to start his third NFL season, and he had already earned his second contract, a 5-year extension. The average NFL career is about 3.3 years, and Aaron appeared to be on his way to playing much longer. The next day, we beat Boston College 41-32. A few weeks later, Aaron called me again with more big news. He was going to propose to Cheyenne. I asked Aaron if he was sure about his decision.
"I don't want you to get hurt like I did," I said. "There's so much unexpected pain that can come with it."
"D, I've thought about this for a while," Aaron said. "She treats me amazing, and she is going to have our princess. I love her."
Aaron had already picked out an engagement ring. 2 weeks before Cheyenne's baby shower, she was in her third trimester, he rented a limousine and arranged for it to pick up our mother, her sister, and our grandmother. The limo then carried them to Massachusetts to get Aaron, and the four of them went to a mall so he could show them the ring he was going to purchase. At the mall, Aaron led the three women to a jewelry store, where he bought a diamond heart necklace for our grandmother, who cried as Aaron clasped it around her neck. Aaron showed everyone the ring he wanted to buy Cheyenne. My mother told him it had the biggest diamond she had ever seen. She wondered if Shy's finger would be able to hold it up. Aaron bought the ring.
"Aaron made all of us feel good," my mother said later. "He was so fun and loving. He was the nice Aaron. He was my baby again."
The baby shower was in October, at the Carousel Museum in Bristol. Midway through the shower, as Shai sat in a chair in the middle of the room, Aaron